You're listening to The Way Home with Daniel Darling, a proud member of the Denham Audio Network.
Hello and welcome to The Way Home Podcast. I'm so glad you're joining me today. We're so glad about this new season of shows, and we have a lot of really great guests lined up for you in this season. Before I get to my guests, I want to remind you about a couple of things that you may not be aware of. First of all, my book, The Characters of Easter, is available now as you're preparing your heart for Easter and the resurrection of Christ and the death of Christ. As we ponder and meditate on those things as Christians, you can get that anywhere books are sold. We'll have a link in the show notes to make it easy for you. I'd love for you to get your hands on that. Also, if you've not subscribed to my newsletter, One Little Word, you can do that if you go to my website, danieldarling.com. You can subscribe to the free version, or you can subscribe to a paid version, which has a little bit more content and some other features there. We'd love to have you as part of that newsletter. It's a growing community, and we'd love to have you to be a part of that. Lastly, I just want to put a plug in for the institution where I work, the Land Center for Cultural Engagement, which is at Southwestern Seminary and Texas Baptist College. If you're looking for theological education, I'd love for you to check out Southwestern Seminary. We have great options, whether you do it online or come and do it in a residential format. So check that out at swbts.edu. We'd love for you to be a part of our community here at Southwestern and Texas Baptist College. Okay, today my guest is my good friend, a longtime friend, Dr. Andrew Walker, and he's back on the podcast. Andrew and I were colleagues for several years at the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. He now teaches at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, which is my alma mater. He is really just a great thinker. He's an ethicist. He speaks and writes about public theology. He has a couple things out that I would love for you to check out. One is a really new helpful guide on political engagement that you can get at the ERLC. We'll have a link to that. It's a just helpful free guide to political theology, how we should think about politics as we engage the election this season. And he also has another book on natural law ethics that I think is really helpful. He is what I would say a natural law scholar, and you may be saying, what is actually natural law? Why should I even think about this? He's gonna explain that for us in this podcast, and something that as Christians we should think about as we make arguments in the public square on political issues, on issues of public policy. His book is called Faithful Reason, Natural Law Ethics for God's Glory and Our Good. It's a really helpful book. He also has a really good book on religious liberty called Liberty for All. I'm not going to keep talking because I want to get to our conversation with my longtime friend and great scholar, Dr. Andrew Walker. So glad to have my good friend and former colleague, Dr. Andrew Walker, back on the podcast. Andrew, man, thanks for coming back. It's been too long.
Dan, it's good to be with you, man. And we were joking before we got on the recording that like we haven't worked together in 4 years, but we literally chat every day, multiple times every a day. So it's like I don't even have time to miss you.
Right. You probably actually wish you could miss me at some point.
Yeah, actually,
you're like, I need 3 days less. Yeah, where we have a fast, you know, maybe you could give me up for Lent or something. So, man, I'm so glad to have you on. I think the last time we talked, we were both working together, or maybe you're on after that, but just really want to talk about a bunch of things you're working on. First of all, you put together a really good guide for political engagement that you worked on with the ERLC that I thought was really helpful. You know, a lot of Christians, I think there's a mix of Christians. You probably find this in your church and people you know. We all know Christians who are, you know, politically obsessed and it's all they do and they worship and all that stuff. I feel that that's such a small percentage of the church, even though all the books and stuff are written toward those people.
Right.
I think a lot of Christians today are asking, you know, how do I do this well? How do I steward this thing that God has given us as American Christians, this unique opportunity to shape our communities? How do I do this well? And so this guide that you put together, and we'll have links to it, just talk about how you encourage folks to walk through that process. And obviously there's different callings. Some are called to run for office, some are called to do other things. But what do you say to both students that you're teaching, but also fellow Christians in your church and in the community, other places you go.
Yeah. So, I mean, we should think about politics before we think about it in terms of like Fox News or MSNBC. It's an incredible stewardship. And politics is really just a fancy term for, or it's a concise term for, how do we organize and manage our life together, particularly in a society with when there's 50 states and there's 360 million people who have, you know, any number of massive disagreements on significant issues. And so politics is messy. I don't want to oversimplify the complexity of this conversation, but I think I want to believe, at least, that even those who don't see things like me are motivated by a sense of concern for everybody, that they are motivated by a concern for the common good. Again, I hope that's the case. Perhaps I'm being naive, but I want to believe that's the case. And so I say all of that because that's why I think I care about politics. It's why I think you care about politics. To say nothing of all of the banter that guys like you and I have about what political biography are you reading and how obsessed are you with this year's version of the State of the Union. It's macro level questions of how do we organize our lives together? What are the conditions for justice? What causes every single person to thrive? And so we want to, you know, politics can be likened to, you know, altering the dials here and there by certain degrees in order to optimize the conditions for everyone's flourishing. You know, we have this term in political theology called the common good. And the common good is really just kind of what the goal of politics is to organize society in such a way where every participant who has a share in politics and in the society is seeking to arrange it for every single person's benefit and every single person's good. Now, obviously, we have like massive conflict over how to do that, right? You know, take you and I talk a lot about offline the problems with public schooling versus our preference for charter schools and school vouchers. I think you and I would both say that if you're pro public school, it's not because you're wanting kids to fail. It's because you believe that that's the best way to educate the most people. To which you and I are simply going to respond, well, and I appreciate that motivation. We think that you can educate children more effectively and more efficiently through our system. But at the end of the day, there is shared between us a concern for optimizing the conditions for every single person's flourishing. And that's really just what it means to love your neighbor, right? I mean, love your neighbor. Mm-hmm. The common good is just loving your neighbor in the aggregate. The neighbor across the street from me, literally, who he and I disagree literally on everything. We probably only agree on the goodness of oxygen. Mm-hmm. I don't want to do any ill will towards him. I'm not willing his privation, not willing his misfortune. In fact, when I vote, I'm thinking, how can I actually help make this person's life better through the policies that person X stands for versus what person Y stands for?
Mm. Yeah, that's good. And you know, one of the things I think Christians hear a lot, especially in this season, and I think there's a part of that that's a good warning. But I think all we hear is the worst thing you can do is be involved in politics. Christians are too involved in politics. They're too obsessed. And look, we know people that are too obsessed and that worship it as a religion. But the vast majority of people that I know and you know, Christians, conservative Christians, are probably lean a little bit the other way where it's like, should we even get involved? And, you know, it's hard for me to see where if we're to obey the great commandment to love our neighbor as ourselves, if we're to seek the welfare of our cities as Christian exiles, how can we be disengaged from the policies that affect our neighbors' flourishing, right? So you think about things like marriage policy that really affects the welfare and the economic status and happiness of our neighbors. How do we just not engage when we actually have an opportunity to have a say, right?
And you know, the great irony of the moment we're living in is like we have this like media narrative that evangelicals are a bunch of like mouth frothing, mouth foaming political obsessives. My experience on the ground talking to people in the pews is actually, we're actually looking for resources on how to think about this. Now, like I think our audiences that we talk to skew conservative politically, absolutely, because they're pro-life. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that whatsoever. But I think my general assumption when I'm talking to a predominantly conservative Christian audience is that individuals care. They're not obsessed, but they're just looking for better ways to think about how to solve these questions of great policy complexity. And then also, honestly, let's be clear here, how to stop the rot in some of the policies that are promoted. And that is one of the reasons we engage in politics, is because, you know, if you, you know, I forget who said this, but I think someone on Twitter said that, you know, the side that wants to just be left alone is always going to be the side that loses, because the determined offensive side is always going to be the side that wins. And that's great if the offensive determined side is producing wholesome detail or wholesome policies. It's awful if the most animated are the ones producing the most decadent and destructive policies.
Yeah. And I just think if you take Christians out of politics or out of public office or out of these things, and obviously everyone has different callings, so everyone shouldn't be at the same level. But if you take them out, you know, you lose what? You lose Martin Luther King fighting for civil rights. You lose William Wilberforce. You know, you lose, you know, all these people that really use their voice and their influence to shape human flourishing, to stand up for what is right. And so I'm glad that you said that. Let's talk a little bit about even party politics. I want to say a little bit, and even a little bit about patriotism. Then I want to shift and talk about natural law and have you kind of explain to us what that is. But, you know, I think the common thinking is that Christians shouldn't be a member of a political party, or they should be careful about joining a political party where, you know, it's not the agenda of the donkey or the elephant, it's the agenda of the lamb. And I get when pastors say that, I actually get what they mean. And, you know, our ultimate worship and agenda shouldn't be that way.
Yeah.
But can we not see political parties as institutions that are earthly, that we can go into these spaces as missionaries to reform them? You know, if we cede these spaces to other voices, we're not going to like what we get, right? So should we not be part of these institutions to try to change and reform them, even if we hold them loosely?
Yeah, I mean, you and I, Dan, have had a lot of conversations offline about the importance of institutions and how there's just basically kind of a retreat from institutions in our age. And I can understand the cynicism towards the Republican Party right now. I totally get the cynicism at the intellectual level. I wouldn't counsel, though, abandoning ship. I will say, though, there is an argument at a certain point to abandon ship. I mean, you can look at, you know, institutions like the Methodist Church, where there was kind of a turning point where it's like, all right, this is lost. We got to do something new. I would simply say the instinct to cultivate is one that is trying to endure and trying to persist. And I think as we're thinking about parties themselves, is to cautiously embrace them and to understand that parties are going to evolve and shift over time. What I think we should be concerned about is if they're going to shift, let's make sure they shift in the right direction. And so I'll get asked the question frequently, well, can you vote for X or Y party? And the first answer I always give to that is, well, parties and platforms can shift over time. The nomenclature can shift over time. What doesn't shift are the moral principles that we have to be, to bind ourselves to. And so if Christians are the proponents and, you know, we're the roadblocks against moral relativism, I really hope that there are some Christians who are showing up and saying, you know, I don't care if the culture is moving in one direction. We need to be a political party that, you know, to quote William F. Buckley, one of my heroes, who stands athwart, yelling stop. And sometimes yelling stop might be one of the most important things that we can do.
I want to shift a little bit, talk political theology or public theology, which you've written quite a bit about. And there's a lot of conversation now about so-called Christian nationalism. You know, as I've written and said, there isn't actually an academic conversation with people who actually are self-described nationalists who, unlike us, who are Baptists, would want a more, you know, a Christian sanction of Christianity, you know, maybe have seen kind of what this form of government we have and say, well, it's not sufficient. We need to go back to sort of an era where we had that. You and I would disagree as Baptists. We want a free church and a free state. But the Christian nationalism term is kind of used as a pejorative against any Christians wanting to get involved in government. You know, George Bush was a theocrat because he quoted Bible verses, and Speaker Mike Johnson is dangerous because, right, you know, him and his son care about.
You believe the natural law? You're a Christian nationalist.
Right, exactly. So talk to us about this conversation. What is the role of, you know, what do we want for our government? We you know, why is it good for us as Christians to want to bring our faith to the public square and influence policy that reflects what we believe?
You know, at the risk of being just a little bit too blunt, which I'm going to be, the Christian nationalism discussion has now been proceeding apace for, feels like, 2 or 3 or 4 years, and it has really become one of the stupidest conversations in my adult
really
life.
Has.
To see it morph into something that originally, I think, was an academic subject that was fairly constrained and fairly responsible, and then has now morphed, as you would expect it to do, to become this comprehensive pejorative used to delegitimize any activity of conservative Christians in the public square. It's very silly at this point. I would also say this. I don't embrace the label of Christian nationalist for myself. But whenever that term is invoked, I always want to ask the person, what do you mean by that? You and I are Baptists. You and I don't consider ourselves Christian nationalists.
Right.
But to the faculty at Harvard or to the editorial board of the New York Times, we now are called Christian nationalism. And again, I mean, let's recognize the play here. This is just this generation's epithet for Christo-fascist, Christian right, theocrat. So this is just the next verse in the same song. And I think the response to all of that is to, you know, to maybe cite Saint Taylor Swift, to shrug it off, right?
That's right.
To basically say, you know, whatever label you want to throw at me, I don't care. The principles that I am bound by, we can just call these natural law principles of creation order, right? Mm-hmm. Existence, identity, family, vocation, cultural productivity. These things have to happen. And if they don't happen, it's not just that, oh, you know, you're disagreeing with Christians. It's that we think that you're disagreeing with the very fabric of the universe, and this is not going to go well. You know, you literally penned a column for World Opinions on Brad Wilcox's new book called Get Married. Let's think about the insanity of a book titled Get Married. Why do we have to have a book that's named Get Married? It's because we live in a time period right now where we actually have to convince people to get married. I think that's like the first time in human history where this has been the case. And why did we get there? We got there because ideas and things happen in the culture and celebrities, you know, and you know, this amalgamation of forces took place in the culture to shift the moral imagination around the very cornerstone institution that we have to have in order to thrive, which is marriage. And so we don't think of necessarily as marriage as a political issue, but it deeply is a political issue because it relates to how we're ordering ourselves. And so, you know, think about to bring this back to the Christian nationalism discussion, why it's so silly. If you were to call for the overturning of Obergefell, that would basically be nowadays akin to saying, you know, let's go back to the Ice Age. Okay, Obergefell is, I think, 8 years old as far as how long it's been so-called the law of the land, although I don't think it really is law. And now if you want to overturn Obergefell and go back to the standard definition of marriage that has been the time-honored, universally recognized understanding of marriage since time immemorial, guess what now, Dan? You are a Christian nationalist. It's just a very silly conversation. And I think the day in which we live right now is you have to actively push aside the inane labels and just stay tethered to first principles. Stay tethered to objective truth.
Absolutely. I want to talk a little bit about our views of government, because I think it's really interesting. You know, we're Baptists, so we believe in a free church and a free state. And so this arrangement we have, sometimes it's called classic liberalism, small L liberalism, not big L. So don't everyone get crazy. This idea that we don't want the state, we don't want a state church, right? The founders and early Baptists kind of looked at church history, looked at world history and said, you know, that's never worked out well for the church or the state. But then some people mistake that to say, well, we should kind of strip religion or Christianity or virtue at totally from the public square. And they have this kind of neutral public square. And, you know, as Jonathan Lehman has said, you know, everyone brings their gods to the public square. I think that was him that said that. Somebody said that. So what does that look like for us? You know, we want to see good policy enacted because we care about our neighbors. We believe Christianity is a good bedrock for civilization. In fact, when you read the founders, even when you read folks like John Locke, they kind of assumed a bedrock of virtue, a bedrock of Christianity when they're making their case, right? And so this idea that, you know, we should have a public square devoid of religion, or we shouldn't root for virtue or Christianity in the public square, really seems foreign even to the founders. So kind of explain where we're coming from as Baptists when we make these arguments.
So I think, you know, one of the reasons Baptists have traditionally never been in the theocratic or theonomic or Christian Reconstructionist wing of political theology, it owes to our soteriology and it owes to our ecclesiology. And the idea is, to be a Christian is to come to a conscientious self-understanding that Jesus Christ is Lord. It's something that happens voluntarily. It doesn't happen when you're 3 weeks old and you get baptized. And upon that profession of faith, you then become a part of this body of believers that we hold to be regenerate, and that this body of believers has a fundamental distinction from the world, that Christians are in the world, but they are not of the world. And so there is a different calling that the church fundamentally has than is different than the state. Now, please hear me. This does not mean that church and state must have this, therefore, impregnable wall. You can't separate religion and politics. You can separate the institutions of church and state, but as we're thinking about the relationship between religion and politics as Baptists, we are not arguing for what I've heard some accuse us of arguing for, of political atheism. That if you're saying that the civil order is not ordered to the highest good, then therefore you are depriving man of his highest good, and you're basically saying that political atheism is what you're arguing for. That's not at all what we're arguing for. We are arguing that the state is not a good disciple, and it's an even worse pastor or priest. And so we want to constrain or limit the role of the government or the state to the actions that it is best called to regulate, which is incarceration, taxation, fighting wars, telling you on what side of the road to drive on, not who the true identity of God is, because once that happens, you're going to start having non-Christians put in the position of defining doctrinal matters. And that's completely anathema to Baptist identity. But this does mean, though, And I want to be very clear that we do believe in a positive understanding of the state. We do believe in a positive role for the Christian to engage the state and to engage the culture. As Baptists, we simply argue that this is a word-centric and congregation-centric and conscience-centric reality. That it is the preached word in the context of the congregation, transforming the consciences of those within the congregation that then scatter and work themselves into all of the various parts of society, and they seek to cite the language of the Baptist faith and message, to bring society under the principles of righteousness and justice. And we're to do that every single location we can.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think about even John Adams saying, you know, this thing we're building will only work for moral and religious people. Liberty and freedom assumes
so important
at least a religious basis, and I would argue a predominantly Christian basis. What I tell my class, my students, and also I'm teaching at churches something on this, is that, you know, Baptists actually want a Christian nation, but we want the Christianity to really come bottom up through evangelism, discipleship, and revival.
Amen.
And we want to advocate Christian ideas, you know, because we care about that, which makes me want to pivot and talk a little bit about, you mentioned a few times natural law. You have a new book coming out called Faithful Reason. It's a natural law approach to ethics. For those who've never heard that term, can you explain a little bit what natural law is, and how is it related to, say, this idea of general revelation and those things? And why is it important for us to think in those terms?
Yeah. So, I mean, natural law at its root is more or less one of the most historic ideas in Christian thought that has argued that God has placed upon the universe and the world a moral order. So a moral order objectively exists. It's like a canopy over the world. And that rational agents, even non-Christians, can tap into or have knowledge of that natural law. Now, it doesn't mean that non-Christians have exhaustive or totally clear knowledge of all elements of the natural law. We do believe that sin has wounded reason and that man suppresses the truth and unrighteousness, but that there are glimmers of the moral law written on the heart, to quote the Apostle Paul, or the fact that every human being, to some extent, understands themselves as having committed a violation against something, to which the Christians want to come in and connect the dots and say, well, you haven't actually just offended or broken the law of something. You've broken the law of someone, which is God. And the reason that this natural law idea is so important is because, if you've noticed, Dan, the whole world isn't Christian. That might be a shock and surprise to you. So that raises the question, if the whole world isn't Christian and we have to figure out ways to pursue justice and to pursue the common good, on what grounds are we going to do that? And my argument is, one way or another, you're going to end up having to play on the terrain of natural law. Now, please hear me say this carefully. That doesn't mean that you neglect bringing up Scripture. Not at all. Cite Scripture. It doesn't mean that you avoid talking about Jesus. Talk about Jesus. But it does mean that your interlocutor may deny that Jesus is Lord and may deny the Bible is inspired. But yet the person who denies both of those realities would also potentially affirm to you that it's wrong to murder, it's wrong to steal. And you know what? It seems really strange that a man would consider himself a woman. That seems like it's kind of a outside the systems of justice and fairness. That strikes me as a little weird, the non-Christian might say. I saw recently on Bill Maher, three non-Christians, Bill Maher included, basically all acknowledge the absurdity of the trans movement and the absurdity of biological males competing against females. Well, guess what? That's natural law. One of the arguments with natural law is you will be playing with the grain of the universe, or you will get swept up with the grain of the universe. And the role of Christians in this is we don't disguise our moral commitments. I want to be very clear about that. I don't utilize the natural law in order to cloak what I really believe. I believe Jesus is the transcendent King, Lord, and Savior of the universe. I also think that Christ has ordered a natural law through himself being the Logos that we read about in John chapter 1 and Colossians chapter 1, and that the universe that we live in and the types of human beings that we are as rational creatures just are the types of persons who have been made to respond to the existence of that natural law. We can't help but respond to it. When a mother looks lovingly into the eyes of her child, there's really two options that we have in interpreting this event. We can say with someone like Yuval Harari or David Hume or, you know, a Darwinian or a Nietzschean, oh, well, actually, there's no real loving moral transaction happening right there. All that really is, explained scientifically, are neural mechanisms, you know, sending dopamine hits in the brain. There's no real content between the mother and the child. Okay, you might want to say those words out loud, and every mother with a child is going to want to slap you in the face, because every mother who's looked her child in the eyes and made this divine connection with their child knows there's something holy and beautiful that's objectively holy and beautiful. That doesn't just have the appearance of holiness and beauty. It is objectively holy and beautiful. And that's where the natural law comes in. And I think we're seeing the natural law play itself out in 10,000 ways right now. Just last
Absolutely.
Week, I saw this clip going around of Yuval Harari, who's a Jewish intellectual. He's an atheist. He's in a gay marriage. And he's a total kind of moral skeptic. And he's talking about human rights. And he literally says, and this is where, like, sometimes the atheists end up doing the work of the Christian apologist for us. He says, oh, well, you know, human rights don't really exist. Human rights are just these, like, fictionalized tales we tell ourselves are true to make ourselves feel better. He literally says, if you cut someone open, human rights don't spill out. Organs spill out. So then where do human rights come from? And this is where you actually have, like, atheists, like Doug Murray, Niall Ferguson, Louise Perry, who are non-Christians, who are saying, like, all right, maybe we can't explain ultimately where human rights come from apart from the Christian tradition, because God has interwoven these instincts and these inclinations and these impulses into the very fabric of human nature and into the very fabric of creation order itself.
Mm. Yeah, it's. I'm glad you brought that up, because that brings me to my last question. Why natural law is so important. It's like God has ordered the world to work in a certain way, and people are discovering that. It's made me think, and we've had these conversations offline, but, you know, our Christian ethic, particularly the sexual ethic, we always see as being sort of the tip of the spear where we're going to be most opposed by the world, by the culture. And so we get defensive about it, but it actually seems like the Christian ethic can be an apologetic in and of itself, right? I mean, we're starting to see folks like Lewis Sperry that you mentioned, who wrote a book against the sexual revolution, and she wrote an essay for First Things saying, you know, only in Christianity do you find this idea of human dignity. And you see historians like Tom Holland and others say, man, all these things you say you believe, they came from Christianity. You know, even some of the new atheists are coming to faith in Christ, and they're coming from that direction where they're saying, man, this transgender stuff doesn't make sense. This sort of CRT stuff doesn't make sense. Where's the belief system that actually makes sense? And then they're coming into Christianity through the back door that way. So I guess my question is, you know, we're often sheepish about our ethic.
Yeah.
And we're a little bit nervous about, man, we're different and we don't want to offend people. But I wonder now if the Christian ethic, particularly the Christian sexual ethic in this era where people are exhausted by the sexual revolution, if it's in and of itself its own apologetic.
Yeah, I mean, Dan, I don't have much to add to that. I just want to affirm that and give it a hearty amen. Yeah, we are living in a time where what I would want to say to people, and I talk about this in my classroom, if you really do read the most sophisticated writings of like progressives and secularists. It's not convincing. It's really not. Right. I remember a while back I was reading some quotes from like Bertrand Russell on how do you make sense of the universe in a world without God and where nihilism is presumed to be true. And obviously, you know, I think this is insane what he goes on to say, but he's at least, he has the intellectual honesty to say out loud, more or less, that, you know, the nihilist has to reckon himself to the reality that there is no intrinsic meaning in anything, and that once you die, you won't miss yourself because you will no longer be, and there won't be any sense of personal loss because you're just dust. And then, you know, the New York Times published this article last year, and I couldn't believe it, talking about how in, you know, 50 trillion years or whatever number they said, at some point the universe is going to collapse in on itself. You know, it began, you know, supposedly in this, you know, black hole, something happened and carbon atoms fired. Well, eventually it's all going to collapse in on itself. And literally the author says, you know, we just have to basically understand that at some point in the future, all of the good that was done, all of the inventions that were created, all of the beautiful literature, the poetry, the music, the aspirations of humanity, those will cease to exist. And there will be no memory that these things ever happened, because everything is going to fall into a void of a black hole. And again, I reject that. But you can honestly say, hey, Mr. Fence Straddler, you've got to pick a side. You can choose nihilism, or you can choose human rights, and you can choose the not only the content of human rights, but the guarantor of human rights, who is God. And, you know, the last thing I'll say here is, you know, Tom Holland has this incredible exchange, and he's not a Christian, but he gets asked, right, what should the posture be of Christians in a secularizing culture? And he literally says, you know, human rights are a belief. If you like human rights, you should merely work the logical entailment of those beliefs to their absolute end. And mind you, this is a non-Christian saying this. He says, ultimately, I would say, you know, if you like human rights, why not believe in the resurrection as well? Mm. And you're like, yeah, whoa. Thanks, Tom Holland, for making my point for me.
Yeah.
You know,
that's awesome.
It's a beautiful way to articulate that.
Yeah, absolutely. I've heard him say too, you know, atheists and people like him to say, hey, Christians, you should not be ashamed to actually be Christians. It's okay to be a Christian. We don't want you to be anything else, which is awesome. Well, man, Andrew Walker, thank you for joining me today. I appreciate it. I want to encourage folks to get Andrew's books, his book that's coming out soon here, Faithful Reason, Natural Law Ethics for God's Glory and Our Good. Be a great textbook if you're teaching ethics, or even if you just want it to have in your library. Really, really good stuff. He also has a Christian guide for political engagement called The Nations Belong to God. You get that at ERLC. He's got a lot of other books, including Liberty for All, God and the Transgender Debate. So check those out on Amazon, anywhere you get books. Andrew, thanks for joining me, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah, Dan, great to be with you, man.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Way Home Podcast with Daniel Darling. For more information, you can visit danieldarling.com. If you do like this podcast, we encourage you to subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcast catcher. We also encourage you to rate and review so others can know about the podcast. You can follow me at Dan Darling on Twitter, or go to my Facebook page, facebook.com/Daniel M. Darling. Thank you for listening to the Way Home Podcast.